Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 2018 session of the Oklahoma Legislature adjourned last Thursday, the earliest in recent memory, and what a session it was. For the first time since State Question 640 passed, the legislature was able to reach the 75% vote threshold to raise revenues by passing an increase in the gross production tax on energy and increases in fuel and cigarette taxes. This will fund a teacher pay increase, averaging about $6,000 a teacher. But of course, it took a teacher walkout to pass it. The general appropriations for the state of Oklahoma will be $7.5 billion this coming year, the largest in state history. And while education, health services, and corrections, a couple other agencies as well, saw increases in their budget, most agencies are still operating with far less money than they had a decade ago. And while the budget has passed, several divisive and controversial bills, including an adoption bill which would allow private agencies to discriminate against LGBT clients, a bill allowing so-called constitutional carry, allowing guns to be carried without permits, and a bill which would allow juveniles as young as 13 to be sentenced to life without parole, are on the governor's desk awaiting her decision. Joining me to talk about the Oklahoma legislative session is David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Last week, the legislature wrapped up what was both the longest and shortest session, if you consider all the special sessions from 2017 going on forward.
Almost out of Dickens.
Yes, longest and shortest sessions in recent history. Now, usually this is a time organizations such as yourself, or your organization, are working overtime to provide information to voters and legislatures on budgetary impacts. But the legislators adjourned, sine die. What struck you as most important about this session?
Well, certainly they did one big thing this session, but it was pretty significant. And that was, for the first time since 1990, they passed a major tax increase in order to provide a substantial pay raise for teachers. That had been an elusive goal for several years to get a teacher pay raise through. There had been various versions of tax proposals that had been on the table over the last two regular sessions, the two special sessions. They finally got it to the top of the mountain or over the goal line, depending, pick your metaphor.
Over 75%.
They did, which is a huge hurdle. And when you add in the fact that you have a Republican supermajority control of both legislative chambers, the fact that they actually were able to get the three-quarter support for the tax package that got the teachers the pay raise was a pretty big deal.
Now, and as far as I know, this is the first tax increase subject to State Question 640 that requires that three-fourths majority to pass, right? In 28 years, and really since State Question 640 passed, right?
Right. So State Question 640 was put into the Constitution in 1992, and it said that any bill to raise revenue requires the support of three-quarters of the members of both legislative chambers or a vote of the people at the time of the next election. So back in 2004 on the tobacco tax increase, the legislature did vote to send a tobacco tax increase to a vote of the people. This was the first time, though, that on an outright tax increase, not closing a tax break or getting rid of a deduction or a credit, but on an outright raising the rate, that they have been able to reach that three-quarters majority. In this case, there were three components of the bill. One was a dollar per pack increase on cigarettes. The second was raising the motor fuel tax by 3 cents a gallon on gas and 6 cents a gallon on diesel. And then they, perhaps most controversially and with the greatest amount of difficulty, they raised the initial gross production tax rate on oil and gas from 2% to 5%.
And that will raise, what, around $400-something million a year?
That one bill, so those three measures were combined into one bill, House Bill 1010XX, and we'll be hearing quite a bit about 1010XX. It sounds a little naughty, but the double X refers to the fact that it was passed during the second legislative session. 1010XX had the three revenue measures. There were some other revenue things done. There was a limit on itemized deductions, which primarily will affect high-income households. And then there was a change relating to sales of goods online through third-party retailers.
Internet sellers will have to start collecting tax.
Correct. Together, those three measures are about $500 million.
Mm-hmm. And of course, out of that, teachers' raises came about $6,000. Is that the average?
It's pretty substantial. So the percentages range from about 18 to 21%, depending on where a teacher is on the salary schedule. It depends on their numbers of years of experience and the degree. So it's at a minimum, every teacher will get a $5,000 raise beginning in August. And then we need to have an asterisk to note that there is some uncertainty, and I'm sure we'll get to that. And then the maximum raise for the most experienced teachers, those who are over 20 years and have a graduate degree, is over $8,000. So when they average it out for the 40,000-plus teachers in the state, it comes out to about a $6,100 average increase.
Now, you talked about this asterisk. I assume this is Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite effort to gather roughly around 41,000 signatures to put to a vote of the people this tax package, right, to overturn the tax rates.
So this is an obscure provision in the Oklahoma Constitution, so obscure that we have not had a veto referendum in the state since 1970. So it had been a fairly commonly used up until then in the first, I guess, 80 years of statehood. There were 20 veto referendums, and then it has fallen into disuse to the point where many people, myself included, had really forgotten that such a thing existed. But the Constitution does allow a veto referendum. As you said, you need 5% of the number of voters who voted in the last gubernatorial election. So now it's about 41,000.
That's not very many.
It's not a high
threshold. How does that compare to an initiative petition? Is it about the same?
Initiative petition, so it depends on whether you're changing the Constitution, in which case you need 15%. If you're just changing statute, you need 8%. So this is the lowest number of signatures. So it's about 41,000, and they're rules as to how you do it. So they filed the initiative petition last week. There's a 10-day period for challenges. They will then have 60 days to collect signatures from the time.
I think it's mid-July. Yeah.
That's the deadline that they will have to collect the signatures by. It gets very complicated in a number of ways. They're challenging the bill that is set to take effect 90 days after the governor signed it, which is June 17th. So it's possible that they would not collect their signatures until after the revenue measures would take effect. And that's going to raise a question of, if there's an active veto referendum process underway, will the tax increases go into effect in mid-June, perhaps to then be stayed 2 or 3 weeks later when the petitions are submitted? I think what we do know is if they collect the signatures, at some point, the revenues will not be collected and will be decided by the voters sometime this fall, likely November, but we're not entirely sure about that either.
So this proposed raise all hinges on the success or failure of this veto referendum.
Ultimately, yes. There's some interesting and technical questions about whether the raise will take effect if the veto referendum is underway.
So the raise could occur, but there would be no money to fund it.
There will be a shortfall in the funding. Right. So this is something that a lot of the education groups, their attorneys are looking at very carefully. It may have to be the Attorney General's office may have to weigh in with an opinion, or the courts may have to weigh in with an opinion as to whether or not the teacher raises will take effect on August 1st. Even if this is being challenged. And there is actually an argument that those raises will go ahead and take effect, but you could end up in a situation where if the voters vote down these tax increases, that there will be a major funding shortfall. You know, this is going to be a game of trying to control the narrative. I think there is enormous support in Oklahoma for the teacher pay increase. It polls extremely well. Legislators voted overwhelmingly for this tax increase in order to pay for it. And I think that those who are out there gathering signatures are working really hard to try to say that they're supportive of teachers too. It's just a question of, we don't need to raise taxes, that we're somehow going to find several hundred millions of dollars in waste and inefficiency, so we don't actually have to raise taxes. So it is going to be a tough campaign, but I think the supporters of teacher pay raise are going to try to make an issue of, do you support a raise for Oklahoma's teachers.
Now, you talked about the support issue, which is sort of a big issue going forward into the midterms and then the upcoming election. You were there during the walkout, and I know a lot of teachers at this point are left very deflated because, yes, they got a teacher raise, but an equally important to them was getting more money into the classroom to reduce class sizes. There is some extra money for textbooks and raises for support staff and very small extra amount of money for general school funding, but it's not nearly what they would feel is necessary to really change the narrative of what's happening in public education. Do you sense that they're still actively involved, or is it more a situation of this is the legislature, you know, this is what happens all the time? Because any teacher with a long memory knows that the rug has been pulled out from under them many times in the past.
Sure. I think that there's a lot of frustration that teachers and many others are feeling about the legislature. And in this case, through really no fault of its own, the fact that there is this veto referendum that's putting all this under a cloud of uncertainty is increasing that. I think that some teachers may just simply withdraw, but what I'm really sensing is that teachers, those 2 weeks of descending on the Capitol, being in the building, talking to their lawmakers, calling, sending emails, really has given them greater confidence and greater competence being advocates. And I think that many of them are going to translate that into involvement during the elections. Hope we'll have a chance to talk about it, but we've seen record numbers of candidates running for office, a large number of incumbents who are being challenged in primaries and certainly in the general election. I think we're going to see teachers continue to be mobilized. I think what's important to recognize is that while the teacher walkout did bring 30, 40, 50,000 people a day to the Capitol, this walkout didn't emerge out of nowhere. It didn't spontaneously develop over the course of a week or a month. This is something that has been developing. You can go back 4 years, 6 years, 8 years to the time when Janet Parisi was a superintendent of instruction and she got turfed in the 2014 elections. You have educators, administrators, parents, business leaders, and others who have developed a real strong grassroots, multifaceted movement in favor of public education that has really changed the debate. So I think everybody is saying, legislators of both parties, that what happened this session was only the first step. We now have to go further and put more money back into the classroom to be able to hire more teachers and support staff and instructional materials. I think that this is a movement that didn't materialize out of thin air in March and April, that was a continuation of years of advocacy. We saw it in Tulsa with the group 49th is Not Okay, with the Parent Legislative Advocacy Committee that started in Jenks and then spread to Bixby and Sand Springs and other suburban communities. We saw 2 years ago in 2016 a big spurt in the number of candidates filing for office and who were actively seeking the Apple endorsement from a Facebook group, Oklahoma Parents and Teachers for Public Education. It got to the point where the top priority for Republican legislators was to give teachers a raise, and they finally got it done, even risking the anger and opposition of anti-tax advocates, whether it was Tom Coburn or Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs or the most powerful industry in the state, the oil and gas industry, was opposed to this. And yet a supermajority of legislators voted yes to those bills. So I don't think that activism goes away. There was certainly some real frustration over how the walkout ended. We're going to continue to see more frustration. But I think those folks are mobilized. They know what they need to do, and they're going to keep up the pressure.
Now, if we take just a step back and looking at just the overall general appropriations budget for this coming year, it's the largest in history at $7.5 billion. But if you adjust it for inflation, it's still, what, 9.4% below 2009, adjusted for inflation. And then if you look back to prior to the income tax cuts, go back to 2000, 2001, it's even further smaller. I mean, it's 11, 12% less.
What we've been saying about the budget, it evokes a novel from the 1960s, been down so long, this looks like up to me. We have had so many years of cuts and shortfalls and flat funding, that what we have this year does represent some real progress, but it doesn't get us all the way back up. If you look back to 2009, as you said, we're still about 10% below where we were back then, adjusted for inflation. If you look at schools that have 50,000 more students, and yet they're getting still about $150 million in less general operating support from the state. You look at a lot of the state agencies, they did get a flat budget compared to previous years where they took cuts at the end of the year and then mid-year cuts. A flat budget is real improvement. But I think everybody recognizes that we have a long ways to go to begin to restore the ability of our agencies to perform their core functions of education, health, public safety, infrastructure. To take one example, higher education this year got a little bit of money. They got about $7.5 million to help support concurrent enrollment programs, but they didn't get any money for operating supportive institutions, which have been cut about 26% compared to 10 years ago, most of that cut having been taken place in the last 2 or 3 years. So I think we're hearing recognition from legislators in the majority party as well as the minority that this was an important first step, but their work isn't done, and that discussions of revenue will have to be a continued part of the conversation.
Now, there were raises for state employees, as well as a one-time stipend for state pensioners, some modest improvement in healthcare spending, increased rates for Medicaid providers, for example. But in a lot of those areas where, yes, even where there's a little bit of extra money appropriated this coming year, do you really sense that from legislators that this whole idea of flat budgets or cutting budgets is inadequate for state government? I mean, do you really sense that? I mean, education is where the focus has been because of the huge number of people at the Capitol, you know, for 2 weeks and all throughout the session.
I think there is that recognition. I think if you talk to folks in leadership, the appropriations chairs in the Senate, Kim David, who represents an area outside of Tulsa, House leadership as well, they realize that it's not just education that's been cut. And at certain points during the session, they had to make a decision about how much additional money to direct to education as opposed to other priorities. And they made the decision to ensure that the Department of Human Services, for example, was going to get money to restore rates that had been cut to foster care families and adoption agencies, to provide a 7% increase in the Advantage waiver program that serves homebound individuals with disabilities. They provided some money to reverse cuts that have been made to mental health providers, which is so critical to everyone's well-being. And I think within the education community as well, there was a real awareness that funding for education can't come at the expense of healthcare and human services and public safety, that they really were pushing for a broader solution. We didn't get all the way there, but we did take some steps out of that hole that had been dug over a long period of time as a result of tax cuts that you alluded to and tax breaks as well as economic factors.
Well, outside of education and healthcare, where do you think the most impactful legislation, where did it occur this year?
So we saw good news on the budget, as we've talked about, the fact that there was this additional money for teacher pay raises, a little bit of money for the formula, although far less than what's needed, some effort to restore cuts in human services and so on. But then we saw the last week of session was a tough one. It almost felt like some of these legislators, having been willing to defy their base by supporting tax increases, had to make amends or do penance by passing some traditional hot button issues that show that they can be tough on God's gaze and guns. And we saw a flurry of bills in the last several days of session, some of them that passed through some procedural hocus pocus, without going into all of that, that I think were disappointing to many, and that are going to leave Governor Fallon some really tough decisions about whether she goes ahead and signs these bills or whether she takes out her veto pen and vetoes them, or the other power the governor has at the end of session is what's called a pocket veto. So if she does nothing on bills that are passed in the last 5 days of session, those bills do not take effect. So there's at least a half dozen bills where various coalitions and groups are mounting serious campaigns to try to get the governor to veto. Some of these have, of course, proponents on the other side who are trying to get her to sign them.
In many ways, it's a reversal of a traditional session, which all of the, those bills usually happen at the beginning of the session, and then they get down to business and try to pass a budget. In this case, it was absolutely the reverse.
Here we had a bill that proponents were calling constitutional carry, in which some of the opponents are calling permitless packing, which basically does away with the requirement that you have a license to carry a handgun, which also does away with the training requirement that the state had in place, and with the enhanced background checks that Oklahoma actually has a good background system, that's basically going to go away. That bill was basically, they gutted a semi-related bill that had been moving through the process, stripped that language out and put the new language in as a floor amendment so that it skipped a lot of the normal stages of committee hearings and several votes. And the final days of session, that bill got passed. The Senate actually stayed until midnight one night to hear the permitless carry bill. So that one was a disappointment for some. There's a strong effort being made now, led by many in the business community, to say this is dangerous. Law enforcement, the State Bureau of Investigation, has come out strongly against 1212, saying it's going to harm their efforts and make the state safe.
There's two other bills I'd like to discuss, and that is SB 1221, which, just as 1212 was, it was originally a bill to expand representation on the Pardon and Parole Board to get sort of a more variety of opinions. And all of a sudden now it is a juvenile life without parole bill.
Yeah, this was a bill, you know, there were some, we haven't mentioned it, there were some strong steps taken in the area of criminal justice reform this session. Not as strong as many would have liked. A number of the measures that have been introduced last session that did get stopped were watered down some under the influence of the district attorneys and prosecutors, to be totally frank about it. This was one, there had been a lot of work about juvenile justice, but they took a bill that was about the Pardon Parole Board and added in new language that would provide for life without possibility of parole for juvenile offenders.
Some as young as what, 12 13. Or 13? 13.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court a few years ago struck down mandatory life without parole for juvenile offenders. This gets around the Supreme Court restrictions, or tries to, but many states, including four of Oklahoma's neighbors, have done away with life sentences without possibility of parole for juveniles, recognizing that in the case of juveniles, the young brain is in such a state of change that we need different rules, different situations for juvenile than for somebody who's an adult. So that's another bill that is disappointing, and that we hope the governor will.
Yeah, it's on the desk for signing or veto. Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's some hope that the governor will recognize that this bill goes against some of the other criminal justice reform measures and will not sign that one.
Of course, the justice reform bills are all directed towards reducing prison populations. But there was also one other good piece of news, and that's enacting some of the recommendations on the opioid abuse situation. So that was also a positive step. But I do want to mention the other contentious bill, which is getting a lot of press right now, and that's SB 1140, which is this controversial adoption bill, which would allow private adoption service providers to refuse to place children with certain families that don't conform to their religious beliefs, even if they accept government money. So this is a real hot button issue as well.
It has been. And, you know, certainly the debate there is between those who say that a private agency should be able to decide where they make placements. But in a state where we have a large foster care population, where we struggle with high levels of child abuse and neglect, which leads to children being taken from their families, and we have a shortage of families that are able and willing to step forward to provide a home to those most vulnerable kids? And should we really be limiting the range of families who are able to provide loving care to a vulnerable child for reasons other than their fitness as a family? So the bill would allow a private agency to discriminate based on the sexual orientation of the parent or a single parent family or any reason that they laid out in their own guidelines.
Yeah. My guest today is David Blatt, Executive Director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, as we provide a wrap-up of the 2018 session of the Oklahoma Legislature. You mentioned earlier, you said, you know, there's a record number of people running for office, especially for the legislature, where many districts that have had single party people registering to for the office, many office holders who hadn't had an opponent in a while, they have opponents. Sometimes they also have primary opponents. What was the reaction you're hearing in Oklahoma City to all of these people running for office?
Yeah, so let me give a couple of numbers here. 4 years ago, there were 67 House seats. So there's 101 seats in the House. Two-thirds of them, there was not an election on election day because the
two parties having nominees.
Right. So it had been decided either on filing day because only one candidate ran, or the seat was decided in the primary. But when you went to the polls on election day, there was no contested House seat. That was in 67 seats. This year, that's down to 28. So we see much greater competition. We've seen both parties fielding candidates for almost all House and Senate seats. And we're seeing tremendous competition at the primary level, particularly among Republicans. So interestingly, there are more Democrats who are running unopposed in the general and fewer Democrats who are being challenged in the primary than Republicans. So Republican incumbents are being challenged in many cases by multiple candidates. Some of them are coming at them from the right, some are coming at them from the center. It's interesting, we talked about House Bill 1010, the tax increase bill. There were 17 House members who voted against House Bill 1010. 12 of those are up for re-election. 10 of those 12 have a primary challenger, and most of them have more than one challenger. So we're definitely seeing people come forward. We're going to see much more electoral competition. The other thing that we already know is that the legislature that meets next February is going to be the least experienced legislature in Oklahoma history. If every incumbent who's on the ballot were to win, both survive a primary challenge or a general election challenge, we would still have a majority in both chambers who've been in the legislature for less than 4 years.
Wow.
So we're going to have a ton of freshmen and sophomore legislators. So the average length of experience after November will probably be less than 4 years.
As well as an executive branch that will all be new as well, because nearly every executive office has been term limited. So.
Absolutely. So if you don't like the job the incumbents have been doing, this is good news, because we're really seeing a whole brand new generation. But it is a lot of loss of institutional memory. We just don't have veteran legislators anymore. In the Senate, there will only be one legislator who will have served 10 years after November.
Wow.
Just Gary Stanislawski from Tulsa is the only one who will go into next year having served 10 years. Everybody else, 8 years or less.
Wow. Well, David Blatt, thank you very much for joining us and give us a wrap-up of the legislative session.
Thanks for the opportunity.
David Blatt is the Executive Director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. You can learn more about his organization at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.